Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our salvation. Amen. Part of our epistle lesson, our second lesson, verse 25, "For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." Our foolishness, God's wisdom. I want to introduce you to three individuals this morning, and I'll mention later why the three of them have a couple of things in common. First, let me introduce you to Julie. Julie is 21, going on 22 years old. She was raised in a Christian family, went through all the classes, the schools, and so on. Now she finds herself in university, preparing for a medical career of one sort or another. She's been there 3 years. She's going to her last year in college. Mostly she studied in the science areas, but once in a while she had to kick over and take up an elective, one of the humanities, because that's required. And over 3 years she's heard a lot about how random the world is. And she's heard about the diversity of religions in the world and how tolerance is the guiding virtue of just about everything. And she heard a great deal about the tremendous advances, and they have been in science over the last 200, 300 years. And now, entering her senior year in college, she's wondering, how does she take what she's learned in college, the randomness of the universe, toleration for diversity, understanding things by way of science, how does she take that and square that with the unique and exclusive claims of Christianity that she heard in Sunday school, confirmation class, and in Christian conversations? And there are times when it simply doesn't make sense to her. Trying to link those two together, to marry those two up, seems like nonsense. And she's not real sure what's going to win. That's Julie, number one. Person number two is Bob. Bob is 59 years old. He is a successful businessman. He's brought himself up, as he would say, by the bootstraps. By any measurement, at age 59, he's a wealthy person. Worked hard, insanely hard, and now he sees the fruits of his success. But he starts wondering as he looks around. He's been successful. And he looks around and he sees people who seem, in his perspective, not to do for themselves, not trying so hard, always, it seems, looking for a handout. And then some people say to him that he's got an obligation, a godly obligation, to share some of what he has, some of his gifts, with those who don't have. And it doesn't make sense to him. Seems kind of foolish, almost nonsensical. Doesn't add up. Julie and Bob are fictional composites, but fairly plausible. Person number three is historical, real time. I don't know where he is now, but in 2006, Jeff was a reporter for the Boston Globe newspaper. With the horror and the tragedy of Parkland, Florida in our mind today, we can remember also, going back to 2006, remember hearing about that savage, that mindless, that depraved killing of the Amish girls in their elementary school in a place called West Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania? Jeff was a reporter for the Boston Globe at that time. He heard those reports. The whole world heard them. Then he also was part of the Guild of Journalists that wrote reports not just on the tragedy, but on how the Amish community reacted to the tragedy. And these journalists saw the Amish reaching out to the shooter's widow, shooter committed suicide, reaching out with food gifts to take to her because family was there. That's what people do in funerals. Reaching out to that widow and saying, we'd like to come to the funeral to be of comfort. And she said, yes, and they did. Reaching out and saying, you've got children, they said to the widow. And maybe you don't have what you need for the future for them, and we would like to set up a trust fund for you and ask other people to fund you, and they did that. And then very publicly, they also, the Amish community, extended forgiveness to the deceased shooter, he who had so savagely uprooted their community, extended forgiveness to him and to his family. Jeff at the Boston Globe saw that, read those articles, saw that many journalists around the world were supportive of the Amish community, but others were not. And when Jeff wrote his article, he was among those who were not supportive of the Amish. They were naive, he wrote. They denied the reality and the depth of evil in the world, they wrote. And they had no right to extend forgiveness to someone who did not deserve it, he wrote. From his perspective, what the Amish did was foolish and nonsense. It didn't add up. Moronic, even. Didn't make sense. These three individuals, Julie, number one, Bob, number two, Jeff, number three, have two things in common. Number one, they believe that elements of the Christian faith, not all of it, but elements of the Christian faith sometimes do not make sense. And number two, they are absolutely right. Because there are elements in the Christian understanding, the understanding and the worldview of those who call themselves followers of Jesus Christ, that by some human metrics and measurements don't seem to add up. By what we sometimes measure as valid and true, genuine, trustworthy, dependable, scientific mindset sometimes what we believe in practice Doesn't make sense. All of this to introduce our second lesson and portions of it. 2,000 years ago, there was a young devotee of a religion. By the time he came along, the religion was already 1,000 years old. He embraced that religion. He lived and breathed that religion. That religion was a religion of the book. And that religion went back to sacred texts called Genesis and Exodus, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And in those sacred texts, the devotees of that religion found 613 different commandments. 248 of them said, you must do this. 365 of them said, you must not do that. And you added them all up, and there were 613. And he believed with all his heart that to approach a commanding and demanding God, you approach that God by way of these guidelines, these commandments, these mishvot, as they called them in the Hebrew tradition. And he loved that, lived and breathed it. That's who he was, a person of the book. But then one day, a lightning bolt from God knocked him off his horse and into a new reality. And in this new reality, the demanding God was approached not by a book, not by 248 precepts about what you ought to or do, or 365 precepts about what you ought not to do. It wasn't that you could have come close to the commanding God, the demanding God, by way of what you did, but on the basis of what you believed. Not a book, but a person on the cross became the avenue to a demanding God. And it was clear to him soon in his ministry, when he ministered to the Jews and the Greeks around him, that for the Greeks, that didn't make sense. For the Greeks, you appeased the God, you sent up a sacrifice, you did the ritual, things you did. The Jews were looking for signs when Messiah was going to come. This was going to happen, that was going to happen, then another thing was going to happen. But until that, we observe Torah, we follow it. And he understood that they saw that as all foolishness. And to them he wrote. He wrote about a man who not only came as God's representative, but a man who hung in shame on a cross. Only nasty people wind up on crosses. Dead men don't come back to life, and even if they did, why should we believe him? Whoever heard of such a thing? It's nonsense. It's foolishness. Doesn't make sense. on so many levels simply doesn't make sense. We who stand in a 2,000-year Christian tradition would agree. There are parts, there are aspects of the Christian faith, when looking from outside it, simply don't add up. You can't calibrate them to our own sense of reality. You can't measure them by our sense of what is real in the outside world. They're foolishness sometimes. You see, biggest picture, we believe that something that happened 2,000 years ago on a little bump of a hill outside a backwater town in a little desert city-state called Jerusalem, that what happened there in a bit of supernatural time travel, all that stuff, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, his suffering, somehow in supernatural time travel comes all the way over to us in the 21st century and adds value to our life and makes promises for eternal life. We believe that to be true. No measure of science can measure that. Most measures of reality would miss that. We believe, as happened last Sunday in this service, that when you come over in a worship service to baptismal font and there you put on, you splash on 2-3 hands full of water on a little baby, that somehow that little baby comes from one family of reality to another family of reality, and that baby has two families now. We believe it. Doesn't make sense. And we believe this morning when we come to the meal, the supper, and when we share in that little thin wafer of bread and drink that little sip of wine, we believe that something happens as Lutheran Christians, that that small meal becomes a vehicle for forgiveness of all that is broken and all the nonsense and the stupidity and the pain and the guilt of our life. It is, as we say, beyond understanding. We go to one of the core teachings of the man we call teacher, rabbi. Call them the Beatitudes. We're not even sure how to translate some of the words, but maybe the best we can do is something like this. Fortunate are the poor. Fortunate are the persecuted. Fortunate are you if people lie about you. Fortunate are the broken. And folks, some of that doesn't make sense. That in measurements, as people look at the Christian faith, just doesn't add up. Paul was getting to a point, and that is that as Christians, we live in two worlds, and it's all good. The world of our communities and our networks of friends, our world of the things we live in and see and feel and touch. And there's another world. A stream of events moving forward and onward to an end, to a purpose, to a destination, God's world. We hold dual citizenship, Paul would say. Citizenship in this world and citizenship in God's world. It's all good. So God comes to college student Julie. And God says to college student Julie, as St. Paul said to the Christians in Philippi, Julie, work out your own faith. Wrestle with the questions you have and wrestle them to the ground. And he says to Julie, Julie, it is true that someday science may answer all the questions of science, but not everything is a question of science. And God comes to businessman Bob. He says to businessman Bob, you may understand that folks should lift themselves up by their bootstraps, but not everybody has bootstraps. Bob, there are some in your world who have a godly claim on some of what you have. They are the lost, the least, the lonely, the left out, and the little ones. They are my children too. Help me take care of them. From many perspectives, that would seem nonsense. But it's God's reality. We live in a reality of going to work and to school and making a home and enjoying our friends and leisure places. But we also live in another reality, another world, another stream of events. It's God's world. It's God's reality. I am thankful, profoundly thankful, that my world is glued together, held together. It is blessed and enriched by things that sometimes don't make sense. Let me give you just two examples. Wives, if you are here this morning and your husband is here with you, don't be real obvious about it, but just kind of glance out of your eye at him maybe in the next few minutes. It's 50 seconds. You didn't marry him because he reminded you so much of George Clooney or Clark Gable, right? Right? And the first couple, 3 years of your marriage, there were times when you looked at him and you thought, oh, good Lord, I married an 8-year-old who shaves, right? Yeah. And guys, you kind of returned the favor. When you were, as a young man in middle school or high school, and you thought about drama was an extracurricular activity that you mostly avoided. But then about 18 months, 20 months into your marriage, you realize you married drama, right? And not only did you marry drama, she expected you to come aboard and be the co-conductor on the drama crazy train. Who can explain that? Who can explain it? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But then things start morphing along over 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, and there's something good about that. And then about 15, 20 years on, you begin to understand that narrative. The beginning of the world in creation, where God finished his creation, then he noticed that Adam over here in his man cave in a place called Eden was alone, and he said, that's not good. And then God in his wisdom brought up woman, Eve, to come up alongside Adam, and they were together. And it was good. And it is good. Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons, wise men never try. Best I can think is that particular married love, love between humans, husbands and wives especially, is some kind of a glorious glandular disturbance which apparently has no permanent ill effects. It's about the best I can do. It's a wonderful thing. Sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it holds my world together and holds much of the world together as well. Example number two, some things in my world that don't make sense but add so much value to it. Our world is driven by caring people. Our world is the better for it. That was not always the case. In the world in which St. Paul and Jesus walked the soil of Palestine, for the most part, life was cheap, very cheap. Outside almost every major town, and Jerusalem would have been one of them, would have been a little area, quarter of an acre, an eighth of an acre. And if people had a child and they didn't want to care for it, they would just take that baby and expose it in this area as identified. And if that baby was fortunate and lucky, somebody came along to adopt it. But if not, slaves were living tools, and slaves, when they were no longer useful, were discarded. Ill people were left pretty much on their own. There are students of the ancient world who will argue that in the ancient world of Paul's time, there was no organized charitable organization. People would help other people, particularly in the family, but anything as an organized charitable ministry, reaching out to people, regardless of their circumstances, that was unknown. Over the past 2,000 years of Christianity, there are some chapters in the book that don't exactly make us proud, but they are the exceptions. They are the exceptions. In the very earliest church, the Christians would come over to that designated abandonment area and take those children and rear them as their own, and they go to the Tiber River, flowing through ancient Italy, and they'd pull those babies that had been abandoned, particularly female babies, and rescue them and, again, raise them as their own. Over the course of 2,000 years, the Christian church has given the world hospitals and mental health facilities and nursing profession and abolition of slavery and orphanages. Why? Not just because there was a need, but because they had been touched by one who had done for them first. The one on the cross. The one on the cross. Moved by what God had done for them, they went out to do for others. And so it continues. In many churches, we go to different places. Emmanuel goes to Haiti. Emmanuel goes to Old Mexico. The people who go there have a very low return on investment, as people from the outside would see it. Often go on their own dime for the privilege of being with people they are serving. They work insane hours. Happens there. But it's not just that we go on a mission trip to Old Mexico or Haiti. In every congregation, I've known people, devoted, pious men and women of God, who simply because their life has been touched by love and care, they extend themselves to go out to others as well. They have 100 other things they could be doing, 500 other places where they could spend their money, but they choose to do things because their life has first been touched by God through the foolishness of the one who was hanging on the cross. Do non-Christians today do acts of charity? Well, of course they do. But for every act of charity in the world, every 100 acts of kindness done by others, the Christian church does 145. Because over time, they know what it means to be loved. Sometimes people looking on outside see such things as caring and ministries and going out to help the lost, the least, the lonely, left out, little ones as not much of a return on investment. But we do it because we've been touched. There's another reality. May not make sense, but it's wise to God. No one is going to suggest this morning, far from it for me to suggest it, that when we come into the Christian church, when we come into a Christian building, we kind of take our brain off and hang it on a hook here, and then when we go out to the rest of the world and go to our daily life and our network of friends, we take our brain and install it again as if we're mindless about what we believe. Not at all. We are to be wise fools, using the gifts we have, first for ourselves and then for others around us, glorifying God and helping others. The following is a true story. I wasn't there when it happened, but I got the story directly from somebody who was there. If you travel to the eastern seaboard of the United States, you come to the state of New Jersey, close to New York City. When you get to New Jersey, about in the middle of the state is a small town called Princeton. In Princeton are some major universities, among them other schools of learning too. But of all the major institutions there, it's not a large town, about the city of Crystal Lake. You have Princeton University and Princeton Seminary right next door. Over the years, it's been 150, 175 years, the relationship between Princeton University here and Princeton Seminary over here has been very cordial, very helpful. Cross-pollination of faculty at times, inter-registration by students, good relationship. But every once in a while, there's a little bit of turbulence. Back in the 1950s, as an example, there were students over at Princeton Seminary who thought that students at Princeton University were on a one-way path to the gates of hell itself. And so the students, or at least some of the students at Princeton Seminary, thought that they would get together an evangelism program from the seminary to the students at the university. And here's what they decided to do. They took some stones, almost some small rocks, about this size, and they would take these stones and they'd take a piece of paper and they'd write some message on it, God loves you, please change your ways, that kind of thing, and they'd wrap it up in a paper around a stone, a rock like this, and maybe put some rubber bands around it to hold it tight. And then when that was finished, some of those students from Princeton Seminary would go over to Princeton University to the dormitories there, and they would take it and try to just chuck these right through the open windows in the springtime to the dormitories of Princeton University students. Except sometimes the windows weren't open, with the obvious consequences there. And sometimes, even when the windows were open in the springtime, those little stones with a message attached, these little evangelism bombs, would hit things like people or beer bottles or whiskey bottles or something like that. Well, the students at Princeton University were not amused, as you can imagine. So they talked to their president, who in turn talked with the president of Princeton Seminary. At that time, the president of Princeton Seminary was Dr. John McKay, a proper, button-down, really all-put-together Scotchman from Scotland itself. So the president of Princeton University called Dr. McKay and said, John, would you mind taking care of that? And Dr. McKay said, yeah, I'll do that. The next morning, he got his evangelists in the making all together in one room, sat them down, and he paused, and then he said, boys, St. Paul asks us to be fools for Christ, but not damn fools. Some who were there said that those were the only salty words that they ever heard Dr. McKay utter, and they were some of the most memorable. We are to be wise fools, using again all the gifts that God has given to us, in our work, using them for His glory, in our leisure, using them for the pleasure of family and friends, using those gifts, eyes wide open, excelling, taking joy in what our world has to offer, being all that we can be, understanding that we live in two worlds, two realities. We hold two citizenships, and we are to be wise. I wondered earlier this week how I could add some memorable pop to this message, something that might really stay in your mind through at least Tuesday or Wednesday, and I finally came up with a plan. And here's my plan. You know how it is when you come into the church on Sunday morning, perhaps. There's a slide what you see. When you come into the church, you see the front of the church, and over there is just the name, Emmanuel Lutheran. Here was my plan. I was going to go to Home Depot and get a couple of cans of spray paint and just add maybe a little note on the bottom of that sign. And it would say something like this, Emmanuel Lutheran Church, the church that doesn't make sense. That would be true, but I'm not so sure that would be really compelling for somebody driving by, right? And beside, I'd probably be looking for a different line of work by about 1 o'clock this afternoon. But it's true, in some components of the Christian faith, in some of the expression of what we believe to be true and valid and valuable, some things from a human perspective just don't make sense. For us, it's foolishness, but it's God's wisdom. St. Paul always writes, not to confuse us, but to comfort us. We are now given the bedrock assurance to understand that in spite of humanity's mischief and evil, in the middle of schemes and destruction, in all the craziness of our personal life and all the upside-downness of world politics, God is achieving His ends. Straight through all of what seems to be nonsense sometimes, there's God's wisdom. There runs the thread of God's purpose. He knows what He wants, and He does what He knows. And what He wants and what He knows is expressed by the foolishness of the cross. His Son hanging there for us, rising again for us. What sometimes appears to us and others to be foolishness is God's wisdom. It's all good. For His wisdom, especially for the Son on the cross, we say this morning and always, thanks, thanks, and thanks be to God. Amen.